You're listening to DTFHN for May 28th, 2026. I'm your open source, or else host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where libertarians discover they need regulation. Today's got that beautiful angry energy of people who built something and then watched someone else put a lock on it. Let's go. One of the top comments on this thread is just a guy describing a weekend by the lake with friends, singing off-key to old classics. Someone strumming guitar. No AI, no optimization, no algorithm. Just people making sound together badly and loving it. And it sits there in the middle of discussion about YouTube's new AI labeling system, like a quiet protest sign at a technology expo. The news itself is straightforward. YouTube is updating how it labels AI-generated content. Since 2024, they've relied on creators self-disclosing when they use generative AI tools. Now they're moving toward automatic detection. The platform itself will identify and label AI content without waiting for creators to check a box. Which, let's be honest, is the only version of this that was ever going to work. Voluntary disclosure in a system with monetary incentives to appear authentic is not a detection strategy. It's a suggestion bot. But pull this thread a little further. The commenters are asking the real engineering questions. Where's the line? Someone uses AI for background music in an explainer video. Does that get labeled AI-generated B-roll over a human narration? A short film that's 90% human footage with a few AI shots sprinkled in. These aren't edge cases. These are the median use case right now. The binary label of AI-generated is trying to describe a spectrum, and spectrums resist binary. What's worth appreciating here is the detection problem itself. YouTube is essentially building a classifier that has to distinguish between human-created and machine-created video at scale, across every genre, resolution, and production style on the platform. That is a genuinely hard computer vision and audio analysis problem, and the fact that they're attempting it automatically rather than relying on the honor system shows real engineering ambition. Now, apply the architecture test. This is a closed platform making unilateral decisions about what counts as AI-generated and how that label affects distribution. YouTube decides the threshold. YouTube decides the penalty, if any. YouTube decides whether labeled content gets suppressed in recommendations or just gets a small tag nobody reads. The detection model is proprietary. The training data is proprietary. The appeals process roots through YouTube's own systems. One commenter describes a family member sending them a photorealistic AI video disguised as news. Another found an AI-generated history video on a topic with almost no real sources online. The content looked authoritative precisely because there was nothing to compare it against. That's the failure mode. Not AI content existing, but AI content filling information vacuums where no human bothered to go. The labeling is necessary. But the deeper question the comments keep circling is whether a closed platform can be trusted to police synthetic content when that same platform profits from engagement, regardless of origin. The tools to detect AI content should be as open as the tools to create it. Detection models that anyone can audit, that any platform can deploy, that researchers can stress. Because if the only entity that can tell you whether something is real is also the entity selling ads against it, You haven't solved a transparency problem. You've created a new trust dependency. The guy by the lake with his guitar had it figured out. The signal-to-noise ratio improves dramatically when you remove the algorithm entirely. We talked about AI knowing its limits. Now here's a system that turns those limits into a superpower. This one's wild. Every combinatorial optimization problem has the same brutal math underneath. You've got a system with n variables, each of which can take on multiple states, and you need to find the configuration that minimizes some cost function. The number of possible configurations grows exponentially. For a protein with a few hundred amino acids, you're looking at more candidate folds than there are atoms in the observable universe. Gradient descent, the engine behind every large language model, is essentially useless here. It slides downhill on smooth surfaces. Combinatorial landscapes aren't smooth. They're rugged, full of local minima that trap any algorithm that only knows how to roll downhill. Nature solved this problem billions of years ago. Proteins fold. Crystals form. Metals anneal into low-energy configurations. They do it not by computing the answer, but by exploring the energy landscape through physical dynamics. Thermal fluctuations that kick the system out of local traps. Quantum tunneling that lets it pass through barriers instead of climbing over them. A team spanning ISC, Bangalore, Washington University in St. Louis, Heidelberg, Johns Hopkins, and UC Santa Cruz built a chip that does exactly this. Their neuromorphic Ising machine, implemented on an FPGA, uses Fowler-Nordheim quantum tunneling. The same physics that governs electron emission through thin oxide barriers. As its annealing mechanism, the autoencoder architecture compresses the problem into a lower dimensional representation. Then the annealer explores that compressed landscape using actual quantum tunneling dynamics in CMOS transistors. Not simulated, not approximated. The physics is doing the computation. The Hacker News comments are rightfully skeptical of the buzzword density. Neuromorphic, quantum-inspired, brain-inspired, Ising machine. That's a lot of legitimacy stacking in one sentence, but the Nature Communications paper backs it up with something specific. Asymptotic convergence guarantees, meaning this isn't a heuristic that works sometimes. The architecture is mathematically guaranteed to find the optimal solution given sufficient time, and the tunneling dynamics make that time dramatically shorter than classical approaches. Run this forward. Combinatorial optimization isn't an academic curiosity. It's drug discovery, logistics routing, chip design, material science. Every domain where the search space is too vast for brute force and too jagged for gradient methods. And this runs on standard CMOS fabrication. No cryogenics, no exotic quantum hardware, no million-dollar dilution refrigerators. The paper emerged from a global network of neuromorphic engineering workshops. Telluride, Bangalore, Kapalkacha. Where researchers meet, brainstorm, and build. This is how open scientific collaboration is supposed to work. Not a corporate lab optimizing one metric behind closed doors, but a distributed community attacking a fundamental computational limitation from multiple angles and publishing the results for anyone to build on. The craft here deserves specificity. They didn't just theorize about quantum-inspired optimization. They built the thing on an FPGA board, demonstrated it on protein folding. Watching the search evolve from unfolded chain through molten globule intermediates to stable structure, and showed its scales. Real hardware, real physics, real results. The next generation of hard problems won't be solved by making GPUs faster. They'll be solved by machines that compute the way nature does. We talked earlier about machines learning from nature. Pause. Now let's turn the lens inward. Story 3. I analyzed 20 years of my chats. 486,000 messages. That's the count in one person's longest chat thread. A decade of conversation with their partner. When you break it down, 28.4% is filler. Short words that look like language but carry no meaning. Another 9.1% is media. 2.4% links. 1.5% emoji only. 58.7% is what this person calls substantive text, meaning 41% of a 10-year relationship, measured by message volume, is noise. The Zeem Drobidium wanted to know if he was a good friend, not in the abstract self-help book sense. He wanted to measure it, so he pulled every message archive he could get his hands on. BK Telegram, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Parsed them into a uniform format and started counting. Who he talked to. How often. When the gaps appeared, the project is a personal CRM built from the record rather than from memory, and that distinction matters. Strip this to first principles. A friendship has exactly two measurable properties from chat data, frequency and substance. Frequency is trivial to count. Substance requires you to define what counts, which means building a noise filter, which means confronting the fact that most of what we type to each other is protocol, not payload. The handshake, not the data transfer. The platform archaeology alone is revealing. Instagram double encodes Cyrillic through Latin 1. Telegram assigns different internal message IDs between exports taken on different dates. Facebook stores the same encrypted messages in three different folders. VK exports everything without asking. And Drobian notes, dryly, that you have to appreciate totalitarian states for their data retention policies. Every platform stores your social graph differently because none of them built the export for you. They built it for compliance. GDPR made this project possible, which means the right to access your own data created something the platforms never intended. A tool for genuine self-knowledge. The comment section splits predictably. Some people have zero close friends and say so plainly. Others have hard drives from 2001 with MSN Messenger logs. They've been waiting 20 years to analyze. One person uses Signal with 4-week disappearing messages, which means the record simply doesn't exist. That's the first principles question underneath all of this. You can only measure what persists. The conversations you had on platforms that no longer exist, in formats that broke through services that deleted on schedule. Those relationships happened, but they left no data. The grid fills whether you track it or not. The only question is whether the archive is yours to read. This one's been building for a while, and the evidence is getting hard to ignore. I've spent the last year building with these tools, Claude Code, Codex, the whole stack, and the experience of watching your own productivity double while knowing someone else owns the meter. That's a feeling worth examining. Simon Willison ran the numbers on his own usage. $1,000 a month in Anthropic Akin API costs. Another $1,000 in OpenAI. He pays $200. That gap between retail price and subscription price was the subsidy that built the user base. And now, quietly, both companies have closed it. Anthropic moved enterprise customers to API pricing. OpenAI did the same in April. No more bundled usage. No more all-you-can-eat seats. Every token your team burns now hits the balance sheet at full rate. Both companies release more expensive frontier models the same month. Opus 4.7 cost 40% more than its predecessor. GPT 5.5 doubled the price of 5.4. And both companies locked enterprise customers. Who sign year-long contracts? Into these new rates. The timing is not subtle. Both are heading toward IPOs. But the deeper signal is that coding agents have become the first AI product category where users consistently generate enough value to justify real pricing. 900 million people use ChatGPT weekly. 50 million pay. That conversion rate doesn't build a trillion-dollar business, but developers burning $1,000 a month in tokens while shipping production code. That math works. Here's where the bootstrapism lens matters, the tool that changed everything. The coding agent runs on proprietary models, metered by the token, controlled entirely by two companies preparing to go public. The productivity gains are real. I've felt them. But every line of code I write through these systems flows through infrastructure I don't control, at prices I don't set, under terms that just changed once and will change again. One commenter raises the question that should keep both companies awake. What happens when GLM 5.1 matches the capability and ships open source? The lock-in only holds while the gap holds. And 1,000 engineers building freely have always outpaced 100 building for stock options. The tools work. The question is whether the tools stay yours. Building on. Now, let me write the script segment. In 1997, a demo called Second Reality had already proven something that the games industry would spend decades rediscovering. A group of Finnish coders, with no budget and no publisher, built a real-time audiovisual experience that made commercial software look timid. The demos scene wasn't a market, it was a party. People showed up, plugged in, and the best code won. The entire culture ran on one principle. If you can build it, share it, and let others build on top. Hallucinate is that principle. Alive in a browser tab in 2026. It's a massively multiplayer online rave. Open it, and you're in a shared space with whoever else showed up. Music, visuals, movement. All synchronized, all real-time, all running on web standards. MIT licensed. GitHub repo open. Contributions welcome. The entire stack is right there for anyone to fork, study, or extend. And look, I know the instinct here is to compare this to whatever metaverse pitch some executive is still trying to make happen with a $30 billion budget and mandatory headset purchases. But that comparison does hallucinate a disservice. This isn't a platform play. This is one developer putting a rave on the internet because they could. The comments tell you everything about the state of browser-based creative work right now. Someone built a similar VR DJ setup 6 or 7 years ago with real vinyl turntable mixing. Someone else mentions the club.zone, a dearly departed predecessor that apparently included a secret platformer puzzle hidden inside the rave. Rest in peace, you beautiful weirdo. One person can't get it to load on Firefox. That's the web for you. Messy, inconsistent, and still the only truly universal platform we've got. What catches me is the IJKL movement keys instead of WASD. A small choice, but it tells you the developer is thinking from scratch, not copying conventions. That's Demosine energy. That's someone who looked at how things are usually done and asked whether the usual way was actually the best way. The repo is MIT. The rave is free. The code is yours. This is how creative technology is supposed to work. Not walked behind App Store approvals and platform fees, but running live in a browser, built by someone who wanted it to exist and then made sure everyone else could have it too. The tools exist. The barriers are gone. All that's left is showing up and dancing. What happens when you take that same energy, loving something enough to make it better, and point it at a 26-year-old city simulator? When was the last time you installed something from a CD you bought at a school book fair in a building that no longer exists? The building is gone. The school may be gone, but the disc works. And this person will not pay for the same game twice. That line stopped me. I will not pay for the same game twice. It's a statement about ownership that we've somehow been trained to forget. You bought a thing. You have the thing. The thing is yours. This used to be obvious. Now it's radical. The project itself is beautifully mundane. SimCity 3000, running at 3840 by 2160 on a Ryzen system with a modern Radeon card. Getting there requires 5 separate fixes, a patched executable contributed by GOG, a mouse acceleration tweak from a Simtropolis forum user named Karina Murray, a D3D wrapper to handle DirectX compatibility, a 4GB memory patch, and the disabled auto updater that's been trying to phone a server that died sometime during the Bush administration. 5 fixes from 5 different people across 5 different corners of the internet, none of whom coordinated, all of whom cared enough to solve one specific problem and leave the solution where others could find it. That's not a workflow, that's an ecosystem. That's what distributed maintenance looks like when nobody's getting paid, and the software still runs 26 years later. The question nobody in the games industry wants to answer is simple. Why is a mass of community volunteers doing a better job of keeping a 2090 city builder alive than any studio does with its own back catalog? The auto updater is pinging a dead server. The widescreen support was never officially added. The resolution options top out at 1024 by 768. Every single improvement here came from outside Maxis, outside EA, outside any corporate structure. Meanwhile, one commenter says they started building their own city simulator because they don't like where the genre is heading. Photorealism over personality. Graphical fidelity over art direction. The isometric pixel art in SimCity 3000 wasn't even hand-painted. Someone in the comments points out it was rendered from 3DS Max lighting rigs, but it had a coherent aesthetic vision. And that vision holds up at 4,000 pixels wide because craft scales and trends don't. A disc from a dead building, 5 patches from strangers, and a game that looks better now than it did when it shipped. The tools exist. The community exists. The only thing that was ever missing was permission, and nobody asked for it. Now, not every platform wants you to have that kind of control. Let's talk about what Apple and Google are doing to push notifications. Every notification you have ever received on your phone was delivered by one of 2 companies. Every single one. Apple or Google. There is no third option. This isn't a recent development. It's been true since June 20, 2009, when Scott Forstall stood on stage at WWDC and explained why your iPhone couldn't let every app maintain its own background connection to the internet. Battery life. That was the reason. A genuinely good engineering reason. 1. Persistent TLS connection per device, maintained by Apple, shared by every app. Google followed a year later, and for about a decade, both companies built the pipes and mostly let the water flow. Now let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because the obvious reaction is outrage at the gatekeeping. But consider what happened when Android 13 required explicit opt-in for notifications. Gaming apps lost a third of their notification audience. News apps dropped 19%. Overall Android opt-in fell from 85% to 67% in a single year. Which means, and this is the part worth sitting with, a third of users were receiving notifications they never actually wanted. The platforms arguably did something useful there. but that's where the reasonable defense ends. Because Apple and Google didn't stop at giving users better controls. They started summarizing notifications with on-device models, reordering them. On some surfaces, rewriting them entirely. Your message arrives at the platform servers, gets delivered to the device, and then a local language model decides what the user actually sees. The sender has no visibility into what happened. No analytics on whether the notification was summarized into oblivion or surfaced faithful. The architecture tells you everything. This isn't a protocol. It's not a standard. It's two proprietary pipelines with two companies holding the valves. Imagine if email had launched this way. Every message routed through exactly two servers, both controlled by the companies that made your hardware. We'd call that absurd. We'd build around it. With push, we just accepted it, because battery life. The engineering that built APNs was genuinely elegant. A single persistent connection solving a real resource constraint on hardware that could barely last a day. But elegant engineering in service of a closed architecture is how you get 15 years of permission that can be revoked at any time. The connection was always Apple's. The channel was always Google's. The only thing that changed is they started using that power visibly. Remember earlier when we talked about building your own infrastructure? Let's pull that thread all the way to the edge, Bakken. Literally. Let me make the strongest case against mesh networking first. LoRa tops out at around 27 kilobits per second. That's not a typo. In a world where we stream 4K video without thinking, building infrastructure around dial-up speeds sounds like nostalgia cosplay. The internet works because centralized fiber carries serious bandwidth. Mesh evangelists are solving a problem most people don't have, with hardware most people won't buy, over a protocol most people will never understand. That's the argument. And it's wrong. But not for the reason you'd expect. The argument fails because it assumes the only network worth building is one that replaces what we already have. Jonah Aragon, who runs his own ISP with a personal ASN and fiber optics, isn't building mesh to replace Netflix. He's building it because, even with direct BGP peering, his entire digital existence still roots through institutions that can be coerced. Aaron fees, corporate backbone providers. Choke points dressed up as infrastructure. What makes the LoRa approach genuinely elegant is the physics. Sub-gigahertz, license-free spectrum. Lower frequency means longer wavelength, which means signals bend around obstacles and travel further on less power. One commenter reported 200 miles of solar-powered range. That's not a toy. That's a communications network that runs on sunlight and costs nothing to operate. Now follow the design principle to its logical end. Mesh Tastic, the most popular option, built a consumer product first, and a protocol second. That's why the article's author ultimately points toward Reticulum, a transport layer protocol designed from scratch for mesh. Reticulum doesn't care whether your packets travel over LoRa, Wi-Fi, serial cables, or carrier pigeon. The transport is an implementation detail. The architecture is what matters. This is the pattern that always wins. Open protocol. Hardware agnostic, community owned. Not a product waiting for a platform. A platform waiting for 1,000 products nobody's thought of yet. The tools exist. The spectrum is free. The only question is whether enough people start building before the next time the centralized network disappoints them. That's our show for today. Before we go, that any of this lit something up in your brain, here's how to fan that flame. One commenter cut straight through it. End quote, I should replace most middle management. It is the easiest part of an organization to replace, end quote. And then Rands publishes 1,500 words demonstrating exactly why that commenter might be right. The article describes a senior leader parsing his calendar on a Tuesday morning. He doesn't know who Mark is. He doesn't know what the meeting is about. His chief of staff doesn't know either. The entire apparatus of leadership in this moment is one person with coffee trying to reverse engineer why they're in a room. There's a diagnostic technique in medicine called auscultation. You press a stethoscope to the chest and listen for what the patient can't articulate. Rands is describing corporate auscultation. Someone schedules 30 minutes. They say, "I know you're busy." They make small talk for 10 minutes. And the senior leader's job is to listen past the noise and extract the signal. "I want to become a manager. I want more compensation. I want someone to explain how promotions work." The clinical observation here is that none of these asks require a senior leader. They require a documented process. The promotion criteria could be a wiki page. The compensation bands could be transparent. The path to management could be a checklist anyone can find. Instead, the organization routes these questions through a human bottleneck who drinks coffee and pattern matches against thousands of previous conversations. Another commenter noticed it too. The main problem is organizational blinders. People not seeing the direct route through fear, ambition, loyalty. Rands writes beautifully about navigating organizational opacity. The question nobody in that comment section quite lands on is why the opacity exists in the first place. Documented systems are open systems. They scale. They don't need a chief of staff to vet your calendar. The fact that the ask exists as a concept tells you everything about the architecture it lives inside. We talked about open system scaling. Here's one that almost disappeared entirely. A Soviet programming language resurrected from the archives. In 1985, Soviet educators had a problem. They needed to teach programming to school children, but every available language used English keywords. If you're 12 years old in Novosibirsk, and you've never seen a word of English, print and for and while are arbitrary symbols. They carry no meaning. You can't reason about what your program does by reading it. The solution was rapira, Russian keywords, Russian logic. Wunka instead of finka. Dlya instead of for. Vivid instead of print. A child could read the code and understand its intent because the language met them where they were. This wasn't a toy. Rapira had tuples, sets, records, file, I.O. Turtle graphics. It ran on Agat, a Soviet microcomputer deployed in schools. The language spec, document number F, gay. 00, the Rye, Jeff, 0, Thauper O, 1. Is a real engineering artifact from a real educational initiative that touched real classrooms. Then the Soviet Union dissolved. The Agat disappeared. And Rapira became a historical footnote. 40 years later, a developer named Alexander Demon rebuilt the entire thing in TypeScript, faithful to the original 1985 dialect. 129 tests, a web playground you can open right now in your browser and write factorial functions in Cyrillic. The Turtle graphic system, the Cherchojnik, renders identical output whether you're in the terminal or the browser. The original spec is in the repo. The implementation contract is documented. Every design decision is legible. This is what preservation looks like when you have open tools, a language that served one generation of students, locked inside hardware that no longer exists, brought back to life because one person had access to the spec and a modern runtime. The AGAT is gone. The code runs everywhere. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 28, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that belongs to you. We'll see you back here tomorrow.